The Book Nook on WYSO was presented by the Greene County Public Library, with additional support from Wright Memorial Public Library, Clark County Public Library, Tipp City Public Library, Dayton Metro Library, and Washington Centerville Public Library.
Hello, welcome to the Book Nook on WYSO. It's my pleasure to welcome back to the program today Eric Rickstad. He joins us on the telephone in, where are you, Vermont?
Vermont, yes.
Beautiful Vermont. And you've got a new book out. It's Remote the Six. And I know there's a story here. What on earth led you to write this particular book? And apparently more books to come.
Yes, well, this is it's sort of a more straight-up thriller for me, FBI manhunt of a serial killer and the FBI agent, who's sort of a by-the-book agent, as you must be, is being told by the FBI director that he has to work with what is called a remote viewer, and this is what the agent deems basically a psychic. He wants nothing to do with it. But they're sort of up against it, not being able to solve these vicious crimes of the serial killer killing families across the country. And they have to team together to try to figure out why they can't track down this person and what it is about him that makes him so elusive. And it as it evolves, it sort of begins to delve into deeper background of this remote viewer and how he might or might not be tied to the killer himself.
I'm going to try to be very careful here because I know it would be easy. There's so much here that you probably don't want listeners to know about because you want them to discover it by reading the book. So I'm going to tiptoe through some of this.
Sure.
There's a partnership here. Early in the book, your FBI agent links up rather unwillingly with another person who's supposed to be helping him. Can we talk at all about this relationship?
This is a gentleman who's very much a loner, and he's enigmatic and has a mysterious background himself, and has this skill of being able to remote view, which is to see things, events that are taking place as they take place elsewhere. So he could see, something that's happening across the country. And supposedly he's been working with the CIA and he's been brought into this case to help out. And for me, as sort of a skeptic, as many of us are about these things, it was fun to play with that and have the FBI agent not trust this person. So therefore the reader can't really trust this person, even when there's evidence that he can do what he says he can do. But he himself may be linked to a background that's similar to the killer himself.
Oh, you're being very careful.
Okay. I know. It's
all
really
right.
Difficult.
Okay, yeah. Eric Rickstad joins us. His new one is Remote the Six. And they're having these weird murders happening. Can we talk at all about the victims? Because there's some similarities among the victims. Are we able to talk about that at all?
Sure. Yeah, so the victims are families, and this killer has been given the moniker by the media, as they will, the Tableau Killer, and he has been setting up families in different patterns, increasingly sort of strange patterns of having them be each tied to a chair at first in different rooms of the house, and then in the same room, and then sometimes in the same room, sort of in a circle with their backs to each other. The FBI is wondering, what the purpose of this? Why is this person doing this? And as we learn more and more about the why, because it is also in the killer's point of view, so it's in the FBI agent and this remote viewer and the killer's point of view, we begin to understand this killer's motive even before the FBI is able to figure it out. And they need to stop this from happening again. And there seems to be no connection between the families at all at first. But as it moves along, there's a very deep and sort of disturbing reason why the killer feels that they're connected. He feels he's doing society a purpose in a way. And that's up to, you know, the reader to decide if they think that purpose is at all justified.
And Special Agent Lucas Stark is very skeptical of this guy that's been attached to him like a barnacle, this guy who supposedly is a remote viewer. He's dubious. He doesn't believe this guy has the ability, but this guy keeps doing things where Lucas is like, oh, maybe this guy is for real. And Lucas has his own creepy family murder mystery going on too. I know you don't want to say much about this, but it's hanging over the whole story.
Yeah, he has a disturbing traumatic event that happened to him and in his family regarding something his father did, and you learn early on, you know, his father is in prison for something that was very violent and traumatic for Lucas Stark, and sort of changed the arc of his life and childhood, so that it's one of the reasons he became an FBI agent. And as the novel goes along, we learn more and more that this father may play a role in what's going on, or at least he's a threat to the personal life of Lucas Stark as the novel progresses and the series progresses.
Eric Rickstad joins us. His new one is Remote, The Six. And I think most of our listeners probably consider the concept of profiling by the FBI to be a legitimate and fruitful endeavor. We get the sense perhaps you're skeptical of it, or someone should be skeptical of it. What do you think?
Well, yeah. So in doing a lot of research with and speaking to FBI agents and doing other research, it does occur to me, and it did occur to me and to Lucas Stark, the agent, that, you know, profiling only goes so far. And a lot of it is me having fun sort of poking holes in this, what's become a pop culture myth that somehow profilers are the key to tracking down serial killers. Mm. And they're far more important in pop culture necessarily than they are in real life. I love the TV show Mindhunter, and I, you know, love, you know, all of that, but it's become such a pop culture myth that they play this bigger role than they do. And Lucas Stark is very much a skeptic of that, you know, and behavioral sciences. He doesn't believe science should be even part of the behavioral science department at the FBI. You know, and he points out that, you know, if Ted Bundy had been profiled at the time, he would have been profiled as, you know, sort of this single loner, basement dwelling, probably very low IQ, uneducated person that, you know, was very antisocial, and you could sort of say, oh yeah, that makes sense, it's him. Whereas, you know, he proved to be someone involved in a serious relationship with you know, the woman had a child, and he was on the suicide hotline, and, you know, a law student, and you know, rubbing elbows with regional politicians, and very well educated and very social and charming and good looking. And so that would not have been helpful at all. And the Son of Sam was caught because of a parking meter violation. And there's just a long list of, you know, high profile cases. The Golden State Killer would have never been caught without DNA. So there's, he is very much against profiling itself. And I had a lot of fun sort of, you know, bursting that bubble of the pop culture myth of profilers and how sort of prominent they are in pop culture. And it was fun to sort of debunk that and play with that.
Years ago, many years ago, I had the late Ann Rule on the program. She, of course, worked with Ted Bundy at the suicide hotline place. She had some pretty creepy things to say about him. And then a number of years ago, I interviewed the journalist Jimmy Breslin. And, of course, he was the guy that David Berkowitz, the son of Sam Killer, was corresponding with. And Breslin was fairly convinced that when they caught Berkowitz with that parking violation, he was in the process of trying to kill Breslin.
Yes, I've read that or seen that somewhere. It's just stunning that what these people are capable of.
Eric Rickstad joins us. Eric, when I prepare for interviews, I studiously avoid reading reviews of the books I'm going to feature or interviews with the authors. But in your case, I made an exception because I saw that you did an interview with Don Winslow for Crime Reads, and I thought, well, I'm going to have to read this because it's Don Winslow, and you and I both admire him so much. And in that interview, I discovered you have a history of a friend from childhood that got involved in some horrible crime.
Yeah, so, well, he was, so I grew up with a friend, and this led somewhat to Remote as well, or solving a problem I had in Remote. I grew up with a friend 5-6 years. He lived in our neighborhood, 4 houses up from me. He was a few years older than me. I was about 12, and he was about 15 when he moved in. And he was there till he was about 19 or 20 years old. Charming guy, you know, affable, could charm your little sister all the way up to your great-grandmother without, you know, blinking an eye, athletic, generous, just a really good guy. And then 2 years later, after he left when he was 23, I think, I was about 19, I came home and was watching CNN headline news, and all of a sudden this what turned out to be the first fugitive chase, live fugitive chase of a criminal was being broadcast live. A helicopter was following this bank robber who had robbed by gunpoint a bank in Denver and fled. And he subsequently ran down a police officer and killed a police officer and then crashed his original vehicle, started shooting at the helicopter pilot, tried to kidnap a young woman with a toddler, shot at her car while she tried to flee, kidnapped an elderly man and his truck, and had the elderly man commandeer the truck while he hid on the floorboard of the truck. And this helicopter pilot was actually a Vietnam helicopter pilot in the Vietnam War. And I'm watching all this horrified. Like, I've seen him run down a police officer. He's shooting live at the helicopter, shooting at this young woman, kidnapped this man. And finally, the helicopter pilot had enough, and he set down his helicopter. And about, I don't know, a dozen police officers swarmed in, pulled their vehicles up around the thing, got the old man out, and opened up the door and shot this fugitive 13 times, point blank range. And I was just horrified and stunned, and the world had never seen anything like this to begin with. And then they showed the mugshot and said the name, and it was my friend. And I was just floored. I could not believe it was my friend. And there was nothing that indicated he would ever do anything like this. So that led to my interest in crime and criminals and how they become criminals. And there was something we learned subsequently that was very, very traumatic involving his father's suicide before he moved to Vermont. And it didn't justify or explain away what he did, but without that happening, he would have never done what he did. It doesn't excuse it, but when you heard what happened, you realize, oh my God, he was harboring this horrific thing and never got counseling. They just moved. They just said, well, we're moving from Washington D.C. to Vermont, and we're just going to forget about it. But of course, there's not any forgetting about something so traumatic. So I've always been interested in how criminals, some criminals become criminals. And then we also learned that, you know, he wasn't exactly the person we thought he was, even when living with in our neighborhood, you know, that he had a manipulative streak. He had a very violent streak, but it was hidden. So that he was a fugitive at the time when he robbed the bank. He was serving life in prison in Texas for kidnapping someone and had escaped. And he had made his way all the way to Vermont in the interim, and I had seen him between him leaving and this airing of what happened to him in the end. He visited us and visited people in his old neighborhood and was just his typical self, but he was on the run. And I had this situation in remote where the killer is separate from society because he's been sort of part of this clandestine private government agency or you know, institution that's been trying to hone his remote viewing skills. So he has no ID, he has no driver's license, he has no money, no way to make money. How is he getting across the country in certain ways and being able to move around and not get caught? And I won't give it away, but there was something, you know, my friend was doing. You know, he escaped the prison in Texas and ended up in Vermont. And he had the same problem. No ID, he couldn't identify himself. He couldn't go by his real name. He was a fugitive. He had no money, no means to get money, no car, no means to get a car unless he did something criminal in itself to keep on the run. And so I used that in remote as a way to move my, you know, the serial killer across the country.
Your former friend influenced the creation of Q in a way.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And that, you know, that how does, you know, why does he, you know, what is his rationale to think that this is okay to have, you know, in his case, kidnapped a kid. But yeah, Q, yeah, it led directly to sort of Q in the, who is also the Tableau killer. He goes by two names. Sort of just extrapolated on that sort of behavior and the need to be on the run and the need to hide and not get caught.
Well, this is a very serious, dark story, yet there are elements of humor which brighten it up a bit. And the relationship between our agent, Lucas Stark, and this new, quote, partner of his, is it Gilles Jarnier? Is it? Gilles. We get some humor out of this relationship. I like the scene where they're in a restaurant and Stark's pretty much had it with him already. I mean, they've just gotten together and Stark's like, get ready to walk off and leave him in the restaurant. Like, I don't want to be with this guy. And I usually, in books like this, I'll pick a favorite peripheral character. And in your book, the second you got to Iola, Kansas, which is a real town, and you bring out this realtor, I just said, oh, man, he is it. This realtor is my favorite peripheral character. I love the way you portrayed this guy.
I loved writing him. He was a lot of fun in the town. I can't even remember how I ended up in Iola, just searching something mid country, you know, the heartland, and ended up on that. And it's a very interesting town too. You know, it's got some very cool storefronts and they're painted in these very vibrant colors. And, he was a lot of fun to write, this realtor. Sometimes they just pop up. And they write themselves, you know, his personality, his approach. It was fun to write, you know, Garnier and Lucas Stark and sort of their oil and water, you know, classic, you know, partnership that's being forced on them. And I did want to have a lot, a good amount of humor in it, just arising from, you know, their own personalities being in such conflict with each other. And sort of their own behavior apart from each other as well. And that was a lot of fun. And I think also sort of necessary, since what they're doing, what the person they're after is such a dark creation, that it helps to have them sort of as this odd couple.
My guest is Eric Rickstad. The book is Remote, The Six. It just came out. And it sounds like you actually went to Iola. Were you doing a little research trip? You described the downtown, and I thought, well, how does he know about this?
Well, we were talking about technology earlier, but before we got on, and I never got to visit there specifically.
Okay.
I was near there a couple times, which maybe led me to that particular part of the country. But I happened to find it. A friend mentioned something. I was, you know, speaking about, oh, I got to find it. And he mentioned it. And I just went online and started looking and said, oh, man, this is a very unique town. It is really, you know, isolated and sort of out there in the middle of the central part of the country. But it had a real vibrant, unique twist to it that I really like. So I just sort of explored the town as much as I could online. And it had a water tower, which I needed. And not that I couldn't make up a water tower anywhere, but,
right.
You know.
When I know a little bit about an author or their process, I always kind of picture them. How are they imagining something in a book? And did they actually go there? At one point, you start describing the FBI headquarters in Oklahoma City, and I immediately thought, oh, yeah, he went out and he visited Lou Burney, and Lou took him to see the FBI headquarters.
That would have been great. What a great reason to see Lou Burney. I only see him at conferences. And so that would have been fantastic. I did happen to go by through there years ago on my way through Nebraska to California on a big summer-long road trip and stopped there and was there physically and have pictures of it that I took myself and just, you know, the history of it.
Sure.
I got a lot of great information interviewing two really great career FBI agents that I couldn't have written the book without it because I wouldn't have known what I was doing as far as the FBI procedure and equipment and technology.
That's another creepy aspect of this story, and I'm not going to say much about it, but it's the fact that Lucas is away from his wife and son, and there's some creepy paranoia involved in that situation. And I also mentioned a moment ago that you did this interview with Don Winslow. And when I interview authors, a lot of times I'll ask them, well, what are you working on next? What's next from you? And the last few times I've interviewed Lawrence Block, he said, well, this is probably my last book. I'm pretty sure this is my last book. The last time I interviewed Ian Rankin, he said, yeah, this might be my last book. And I didn't believe either of them. But when I had Don Winslow on for his last book, he said, yeah, this is my last book. I'm retiring. So this week I was kind of astonished when I got an email from his publicist and they said, oh, yeah, we're going to be working a new Don Winslow book. And I'm like, wait a minute. And then I read your interview with Don and I'm like, well, there's no mention of Don's book. What do you know about this?
I don't. This is a surprise to me, a good surprise. I wondered how he could keep himself from not writing, or anyone can that's written for so long. It sort of won't leave us alone even if we would like it to. So I'll have to ask Don and our mutual agent and find out what this is about, because
okay.
it sounds fabulous to me.
I'm sure Shane can fill you in.
Yeah.
Well, I got suspicious a month or two ago when I heard that he showed up in Tucson for this big book festival and he had his picture taken with all these other authors. So I thought, well, maybe he just misses it all. And then I thought, no, I'm getting suspicious.
Yeah, that's suspicious behavior.
Well, bless his heart, he's been a big supporter of yours.
Oh, he has been. He and Shane and Lou Burney and so many other great writers and writers I've admired for a long time.
This new book, Remote the Six, apparently is part of a series. You mentioned that. I don't know how many books you're looking at, but I do know that you have another book coming out, Lickety Split. Is it called Remote the Five?
Yes. Yeah, and that's July 8th.
What's going on, Eric?
Well, we learn a great deal more about who this killer is and who this Giles Yarner is, the remote viewer who's helped track him down in the first book. And, you know, without giving anything away, how they really, there is a connection between them. And it goes back a long ways and involves, you know, some sort of fun and clandestine CIA and government, institutions and some that are not well known that they were both a part of.
Well, the last time we had you on was for your previous book, Lilith, which dealt with some pretty heavy-duty issues surrounding gun violence. And when I think of Don Winslow, I think of a guy who shows his political side. I don't think of you that way, particularly, although I know you have one. You are writing this book about this FBI agents, and I pictured you being slightly aghast. You just referred to an FBI agent as, you must be this way at the FBI, but that's what seems to have all changed here suddenly.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, one would hope that's how most, you know, field agents still are, that you know, and that's how I believe, you know, most, a great many of them are, you know, on the work day in the field doing their job, the reason they've come on board to do this very serious work, you know, to you know, help keep citizens safe and you know, arrest and help convict very serious criminals. And the people that helped me with it were astoundingly professional and really very, very helpful for getting inside information on you know, how the FBI or a agent could, you know, get to a house in the middle of nowhere and surveil it from a distance, mm-hmm. and, you know, those types of things, or how quickly they could get a warrant and that type of thing.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on 91.3 WYSO, Fact-Based Journalism in Service of Democracy. My guest has been Eric Rickstad. His new book is Remote, the Six. And coming up this summer, the next book in the series, Remote, the Five. And, wow, this one's a real page-turner, and I have an advanced copy of the second book. I can't wait to read it. It's such a treat to talk to you again, Eric. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
So how do you write so fast, Eric?
Because I don't do anything else. I do. I mean, I love hanging out with my family, and I love fly fishing and doing stuff outdoors. But it's just that compulsion to write. If I'm not working on something or many somethings at once, I get stir crazy. I really don't know what else to do. There's just so many things that I want to get down, and stories and novels and other things I want to get put on paper that, you know, I'm just compelled to do it. So I'm always working on something, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 hours a day, just like anyone else goes to work. So I sort of like Ray Bradbury had I'll be paraphrasing, but, you know, he had a phrase of along the lines of, you know, I hope I die before I run out of ideas. Because, you know, not that he would ever have run out of ideas, but he feared that, you know, kind of, I don't know what I would do if I wasn't writing, which is why I'm not wholly surprised. I had no idea, but I'm not wholly surprised that Don's back in the ring, so to speak.
Mm. You guys are passionate about it. Thanks again, Eric.
Thank you very much, Vic. I really appreciate it.
You've been listening to The Book Nook on WYSO. Thanks for listening. For The Book Nook, I'm Vic McInnes.